I see hypnosis not as a discrete intervention, but more as a framework for working with and understanding the unconscious. And so,
a driving force for me has always been that I wanted to make the world a better place.
Now, all this new attachment science is creating a revolution.
You can't really argue against the effectiveness of psychotherapy at this point.
You know, maybe you identify as more of like a vanilla, and you got the, you know, you got this client that, you know, really loves Ben and Jerry's.
In rage, which we've all had one or two experiences if you've ever driven on the 405, you're offline cortically. You are animal. You are all id, as the Freudians would say.
I think we have a responsibility not just as a field, but an individual responsibility that's on each one of us to be accountable for our work, to not reach that place of functional adequacy and then stop trying to get better.
Helping the beginning structural family therapist to slow down.
But I do not think this is like the other health fields. This is, to me, an art.
Science gives clients reason to believe in us.
You are the instrument, and it's as much an art as it is a science.
This is how really good couple therapy or really good family therapy helps people in crisis. It helps them turn to each other and be there for each other and find the strength to turn and deal with the world.
I've long observed that anyone trained in hypnosis and who gets experience using hypnosis becomes a better therapist in talk therapy.
Welcome to Talking Therapy. I'm RJ Thomas.
Welcome to the show. I'm John Weber.
Tonight, we're sitting down with
David Godeau.
David Godeau.
He's a clinical psychologist, of course.
In Long Beach, California.
Long Beach, California, and you know, probably other places, but that's where he's housed.
He may be roaming. He may have a VW bus and cruise the landscape doing.
I always thought it'd be great to have a mobile therapy service. And I was really behind it until I thought up the name, Heads Will Roll. And I decided it probably wouldn't go over real well, except in maybe certain beach communities.
It is probably, it's probably some law, some probably some legal, you know, reason you can't do that.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you know there's like, I looked this up. There are in California, I'm trying to think, I think I might have this wrong, but there are something like 265 laws.
Yeah.
Regarding being a therapist, that seems like a lot.
I guess.
But they keep adding more.
Well,
every,
in
like
our
in the,
state,
in the magazine,
roughly 5,000 new laws every year, and I'm right. Not aware of any of them. I could live without
most. I mean, that's when you couldn't
live without.
You give a legislature a full time job, and that's what they do. They
right.
create laws.
Yeah, that is their purpose. I guess they're doing a great job.
Yeah, I guess. But that seems like a lot. It seems like that would be tricky to kind of keep track of all that.
Well,
and how would you
5,000 a year? I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
There's so many things I guess I shouldn't even say about it, but
it's interesting. It's a tricky
conundrum.
It's an interesting field. That might be an interesting conversation for us at some point.
For us to go into the legislature, maybe?
No, to talk on the show about, you know, not so much about law
the
and
laws,
ethics, but
all the new laws.
This being a licensed profession.
Right.
That has this overarching, you know, legal framework.
So much
to it.
Legal and ethical mantle
yeah.
to carry.
Not so much. We did the show with Nicole Stroller Peterson about therapists,
right.
you know, court prep, which you can go check out.
Right. But just being aware of, again, carrying the mantle of this responsibility.
Yeah.
Is part of
and,
our career.
And also how it, you know, how it impacts and affects us.
Yeah.
As therapists and what we do.
Right.
Boy, that'd be an interesting show. Maybe we should do that.
So let's just say real quick before we talk about our
oh, yeah,
sponsor.
We're introducing a show.
Yeah.
David Godeau.
Godeau is a clinical psychologist in Long Beach. He's going to talk to us about Alfred Adler, number one.
Right.
He's an Adlerian
right.
therapist. And we all hear about Alfred Adler, and many of us who are lucky enough to really study him know we owe a lot to Alfred Adler. In family therapy, in birth order, so many other things.
He was also, I understand, the inspiration for the name AA. No, I'm kidding.
No. In addition, there's another really unique aspect of our guest, David Godeau, another branch of how he works that we'll kind of keep as a secret. Well,
you
gotta listen to the show.
Are getting sleepy.
You are getting very interested in the Talking Therapy podcast. Yeah. So there's a hint.
Don't drive off the road.
But first... tell us about our fabulous sponsor.
Yeah, hang on. I have to get my notes. And yeah. I keep talking
because there's so many good things to say. We're talking, of course, about Ben Caldwell Labs.
Yeah, this episode is sponsored exclusively by Ben Caldwell Labs, bencaldwelllabs.com. Ben Caldwell Labs is creating a generation of more empowered, more effective mental health professionals. They offer a license exam prep, continuing, God, every time I blow that one.
But it's your thing now, so
continuing education. That's and then right. The second time, it's easy. Continuing education.
But we're not going to forget that Ben Caldwell Labs helps with continuing education.
Continuing education.
So it's actually a beautiful thing.
So license exam prep, continuing education, advocacy, tools, and training. They offer online test prep for MFTs, law and ethics. They offer continuing education for law and ethics. We have to do that, you know, every year,
right.
Every 2 years, every time we renew our license.
We're all in this together.
We have to go get, you know, do the law and ethics CEUs.
That's right.
So you can get them from Ben Caldwell Labs. Ben's you know, you guys may know Ben. You may see especially if you are on Facebook in any of the therapy groups. He's often. You know, kind of the
right there,
kind of the source. He's the right. guy. He's right. the authority when it comes to certainly anything law and ethics related or related to the BBS. He's constantly, you know, going up to Sacramento and harassing them about something to make our lives better.
We're very lucky to have him here.
No, I guess that's it. All right.
Ben Caldwell Labs. Check them out.
BenCaldwellLabs.com.
They'll take care of you. They'll get you set up.
I was going to say also, if you want to write to us, tell us we're nice guys, you know, suggestions for show.
Yeah. Very much
please
so.
Do that at talkingtherapypodcast@gmail.com. You can check out our website, talkingtherapypodcast.com. And
every Sunday on Facebook, we have new postings. Articles that are of interest to therapists or those who are interested in psychotherapy. We do some nice, you know, Sunday morning humor. You can see the best of cartoons that might be therapy related.
Yeah.
Big following worldwide. People love it. And they so every Sunday, go check us out, Facebook.
And if, you know, I mentioned this one time before, but if we, you know, I always feel guilty. I always feel weird asking people to give us good, you know, give us ratings on you know, in the podcasting app, because it's kind of like, I don't know, tell me you like me, please. Feels just weird. But
if you like the show, if you help us in some way.
It can help us, yeah.
We just want to get the word out. So, and if you don't rate us, you know, tell two or three therapist friends about it.
It's like that old good. It's like that old shampoo commercial.
Right.
And she'll tell two friends, and she'll tell two friends, and they'll tell two friends, and so on and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing.
Do we just date ourselves? Probably.
Well, I'd never date me. No. So anyway,
all right. Let's jump right into this episode.
Whether you're suggestible or not suggestible, you're going to enjoy this show.
Oh, that
this
was good.
Episode
okay.
with,
good,
with
good.
Mr. David Godot, Dr. David Godot.
Here we go.
All right.
All right. Hang on a second. Before we jump into this episode, I want to jump back in here. This is RJ without John. John's not here at the moment, but we thought this was really important. And so right before we're going to upload this, I decided to come back in here and record this and let you guys know that we have a really, really cool announcement. So Simple Practice, which a lot of you guys know as a practice management site, probably a lot of you guys use it, is getting into doing CEUs. So they've got a new facet or aspect to their site, which is Simple Practice Learning. And some of our episodes are going to be up there for CEUs. So go give that a look. It's simplepractice.com/learning and check it out. And now without further ado, I know you've been really waiting for this episode with David Godot. We always wind up talking.
So
a lot of the interesting stuff happens off mic before
right,
we forget.
Right, and you can hear me, hopefully.
Yeah, I can hear
Sometimes
you.
Sometimes we never know.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. We're on. So, David, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. John, did you want to get started? You want to introduce David?
I thought I'd just stay quiet during the show.
That would be a rare.
Be a rarity. Well, I did meet David in our peer group. You recently joined, or
right.
I don't know, hopefully you've joined.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed speaking with you and learning just a little bit about you and enough to know that I wanted our listeners to get to meet you as well.
That's cool. Thank you for inviting
me. We could have just had them over for coffee because there's only two,
right.
I think. But
we've doubled our listeners. Yeah,
four? Viewers. Yeah. Oh, now it's up to two.
We had one. Yeah. One good listener.
That we knew of.
One good one.
Might have been someone's cousin. I don't know. But you know, yeah, we put the show together a while back, and you know, initially for people that were trainees or associates and interns, what have you, and we found that people who'd been in the practice for a long time were listening. And so we're always both keeping our ear to the ground to, you know, people that are interesting and innovative, new ideas, fresh approach, something to say.
Or just old ideas, stuff that I don't mean old, like, you know, tired and old, but stuff that, you know, there are things that you hear of going through school that you always hear of, you know, working with others and groups, and to get a little bit of perspective on older ideas too is a good thing. We'll go into depth on some of that.
What a great segue. Because one of the many things I liked about meeting you, I have been introduced mostly through social media to a small number of people who attended the Adler School.
Right.
And I heard that you did attend the Adler School.
I did. I did my master's in counseling there and my doctorate in clinical.
And so I definitely wanted to talk to you about that and other things.
So what is the Adler School?
Yeah.
The Adler School, it's expanded quite a bit. It started as the Adler Institute. It's in Chicago. And it was founded by kind of direct progenies from Alfred Adler, who was contemporary of Freud and Jung.
Mm-hmm.
Most people have heard his name, but have had kind of like the Psych 101 introduction to him.
Right. I remember him from the Theories of Personality class my first year.
And they usually talk about will to power and
inferiority,
personal mastery.
Complex.
Exactly. Yeah.
Style of life, style of living.
Yeah, kind of... I'd be surprised if you had heard about the style of living in the Psych 101 classes,
but you should have because
it's really...
Well, beyond that, grad school
is
where I first became familiar
with
Alfred Adler.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so what I found interesting about him, and I know you have some stories, but I found it interesting, he was the second son of a family of about 5 kids, and when I heard that his older brother's name was Sigmund, it blew me away.
You know, I've never heard that before.
Because he and his older brother had a confrontational relationship, and his brother was Sigmund.
Huh.
And so he went on, apparently, the stories are he was a student of Freud's, although the more I look, it looks more like he may have been...
Oh, Freud. Oh, I thought you were talking about Sigmund the Sea Monster from the
70s. Sigmund the Sea Monster. I don't know. But you know, you think what they tell you is, oh, he was a student of Freud's, and they had a falling out. But when you look at some of his work, there were a lot of things that he'd already written about and he was working on that predated his relationship with Freud. And so I always viewed them as more contemporaries rather than a student. I don't know how he viewed himself.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of cross-fertilization there, probably a lot more than historically we've sort of talked about, because all of psychoanalysis got lumped in together when there was the big behavioral revolution, and now we're kind of sifting through and finding out, you know, oh, wait a minute, there was a lot of neuroscience that now is verifying Freud's ideas, and who else was saying interesting things, and the whole, you know, birth of attachment theory.
So I picked up an old book I had on Adlerian counseling, and just to check my math, because I knew some things, I wanted to make sure. And so I was able to affirm what I'd understood. Is if you really wanted to understand, I'm not saying the only, but some important roots to family therapy, you could easily go to Adler and see that he was doing family therapy. He had community clinics he opened in the community.
Right.
He put on lectures around mental health and physical health. He was a strong advocate for women's rights early on. He was an amazing guy. And maybe even a precursor to solution-focused thought.
Absolutely. I definitely think that Adler was the original popularizer of brief therapy ideas. I don't think that anybody before Adler was doing anything like that in psychiatry.
Not familiar.
I don't know.
And Adler was actually Freud's personal physician for a long period of time before he became a part of the Vienna Society. And then they had, like everybody that had any interaction with Freud, eventually they had a falling out.
So do you know anything a little more in depth about that? That he actually was his family physician?
Yeah. He was. He psychoanalyzed Freud and was his personal physician for a long period of time.
So tell us a little bit more. We're getting kind of off on Adler.
Sure.
We were talking about the school
and
what that was all about, what was happening there and what you went to study there.
Right. So I actually ended up at the Adler School. I had never heard of Adler through undergrad up until my advisor in my senior year of undergraduate was an Adlerian and had trained at the Adler School, and he did a lot of organizational work. And he introduced me to some of these Adlerian ideas. Adler and his students, Dreikers and Mozak, who are the two men who went on to found the Adler School or the mm-hmm. Adler Institute, mm-hmm. They used to like to do, you know, like John was saying, these public demonstrations and community events, and they would actually do family therapy, brief family therapy mm. in this public context. And a family would come up and they've got this issue, and let's work with how, you know, how you're doing this thing and how you're approaching the world. And so my advisor, he was talking to me about specifically some of the more intrapsychic Adlerian concepts. He was talking about the idea of early recollections. Are you guys familiar with how this works?
Well, I will say this. I always thought that was Freud until I realized that had been Adler.
The analysis of early recollections. Really? I haven't heard Freudians talk about that type of thing.
No, my misunderstanding.
Oh, okay.
And it was Adler.
Yeah.
So what is it?
It's essentially a projective technique. Mm-hmm. The early recollections, typically the way that you'll try to understand a patient in the Adlerian framework is you'll try to understand their lifestyle, their style of living in the world, and their style of making a place for themselves. And so the idea is that we basically come to do that in a consistent set of ways across a variety of contexts, and that furthermore our memory shifts over time, because the way we reconstruct our memory mm-hmm. is self-affirming. We develop a sense of ourselves, and we search for evidence to support that conclusion and to propel us forward. And so if you ask someone for a series of early recollections, tell me something that you remember from before the age of 8, mm-hmm. something in particular, not on summers we used to go to grandma's, but like that one summer when we went to grandma's and this happened. And by collecting a few of these early recollections, you can start to see very distinct patterns in the way that a person sees themselves in relation to the world, the way they see themselves in relation to men, to women, to adults, to authority figures, to peers, to themselves, and in looking at those relationships, you see the way that a person will generally see themselves today, because it's based on their current recollections, not the way that things actually necessarily
happen. In other words, their early recollections, they're selecting based on how they interact with the world now.
Exactly.
As kind of a confirmation of what they do.
There are a million different ways that I could remember myself, or a million mm-hmm. different events that I could select from my past to
These
remember
the ones
myself
that I choose.
Now.
Which ones you choose are telling.
The ones that I associate sure. to and naturally yeah. am drawn to are the ones that are consistent with my current frame of mind, and so they tell you about who I am today.
Mm-hmm. So I do want to segue a little bit, because sure. this was the moment I knew I wanted to interview with you, that I wanted you on with us. Early recollections, let's segue to what you told me, a story about Alfred Adler on a memory he had as a child.
Adler in the cemetery. This is a famous story, and I when I told you the story the first time, I wasn't sure how apocryphal it was, because it had been a lot of years since I heard it.
So you had a different memory of the one that you have now.
I could have. But actually, the memory was pretty accurate. My memory, not Alfred's memory, because what happened was, so Alfred Adler was a very kind of sickly child. He had a lot of health problems. And he, from an early age, kind of had this series of experiences of needing to master himself in order to succeed in the world, of needing to overcome these, infirmities and weaknesses. And that kind of speaks to his later philosophy and psychology around this will to power and will to competency. And so he had this memory that, that I believe he was around 8 years old. And there was, on the way to the schoolhouse from his childhood home, was a cemetery that you had to go through in order to get to school and back. And he was terrified of this thing. And all the other kids didn't seem to have a problem with it, they just went about their way. But he would like wait behind them as they were going, to and from school, in order that he could kind of run around it, or, put his bag down on one end and run, back and forth. Well, he he decided one day, based on this kind of, you know, character structure that he was developing even at that age, of trying to overcome these weaknesses, and he decided, okay, there's no way I'm going to keep dealing with this. So he puts his bag down at one end of the street by the cemetery, and he runs back and forth through the cemetery over and over again until he doesn't feel scared anymore. And then from that time on, you know, he had mastered his fear, and he was capable of just walking to and from school like all the other kids. Now, when he was in his 30s, he was talking with an old friend, and he had gone on, you know, to some notoriety and a lot of professional accomplishment, and had moved from his small hometown. And he was talking with an old friend from school, and it came up, this story, and the friend said, "What are you talking about? There was no cemetery in between, you know, by the school." And he said, "Well, of course there was. I have, you know, here's this event that happened that was very important to me." And he was so jarred by this revelation that he went back to his hometown to explore. And sure enough, there was no cemetery by the schoolhouse. He even went so far as to go to the Hall of Records in his hometown to find out had there ever been a cemetery. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There had never been such a cemetery. Wow. He had somehow invented or acquired this set of memories. And it became his story because it was so consistent with the personal psychology that he developed.
It's so interesting. You know, we've obviously there's been stuff in the news recently about memory and events, and it's so interesting how and I deal with this all the time when I'm working with. It's one of the reasons I love to work with families or couples, because when you're working with an individual, and you might meet somebody else in their family, and you hear these stories, and none of them are anywhere close to the same. You know, it's all sort of the way that memories are formed.
That's someone's experience, and then you don't have that experience. You see it a different way.
And it could be even total, like completely different events. You know, you said this, no, I didn't. You did this, no, I didn't. We did this, no, I didn't.
Or if you've ever done a collaborative view, like Virginia Satir had this intervention called the daily temperature reading, you go around and everyone will chime in on the same things, and you'll see in the room how people are shocked and dismayed that one person has a different view of something, and maybe there'll be a coalition where two agree and then three don't. It's very interesting about us.
You know, it gives me this interesting idea. I'm sure you guys are familiar with the internal family systems model.
Mm-hmm. Especially RJ.
In my training, it was more the ego state model, but essentially the same bones. And it just kind of makes me wonder, you know, if you think about this type of intervention with a family, of checking in with different ways of seeing yourself, I wonder what it would be like to check in with, you know, different perspectives on self, you know, intrapsychically within an individual.
Yeah. Well, and it also goes to that idea of the early, you know, recollections and telling you a little bit more about a person. If you approach it from the standpoint of, well, these may be actual memories or they may not be. And there's no way in an individual, you know, counseling session you would ever know what's true. It just gives you more strength to that idea of this is how this person is seeing themselves and creating their own sort of personal mythology, maybe.
I think that's such a powerful idea for psychotherapy, because there's this temptation when a client is telling us their story, there's this temptation to side with them, to join with them and believe that the story that they're telling you is the literal truth.
Well, in fact, some theories, that's the expectation, is you're going to just, okay, you know. And for me, it is their experience. So like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But they change sometime in the middle. They'll have a new experience.
If we believe their version of the story that they come to us with, and we become credulous in that way, we lose the perspective, you know, to say, well, maybe this is your truth at the moment, but what will your truth be after you have, you know, some other experience, after you see yourself in a different way?
And in some sense, it's interesting because, you know, do we collude with clients in that sort of history and that sort of, developing their personality in that way, or reinforcing their personality in that way? Or do we challenge them about things? And it's hard to know where to even.
So somewhere between a strict Freudian and a Rogerian, maybe, you're not too quick to rush in or too quick to stay and be the blank slate.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because Ben Caldwell was talking, the last interview we did with him was talking about a book by Bill Doherty called Soul Searching?
Sounds familiar.
I think that's what it is. I'll look it up. Okay. Where he was talking about, Bill Daugherty was talking about the responsibility of therapists to kind of challenge people and not just, you know, reflect and right. affirm, but to sort of challenge what their
particularly if you, I mean, you do have to use yourself as an instrument. So if you perceive something, then others may perceive it too. Yeah. And it may be a reason that they have trouble. So another thought, but I want to know what you think and what Adlerians think. Obviously, I'd heard very little about Alfred Adler, but as young as 11, I knew who Freud and Jung were.
Right.
And so I wonder if the Freudians got a foothold in North America sooner, and so it was nearly impossible for the Adlerians to do so. But now it seems like Freud has sort of been put to bed in many ways, and his accomplishments are great. But I see Adler mentioned more and more, you know, now.
You know, that's a unique experience. I rarely hear Alfred Adler mentioned, to be honest.
I don't know what parties you're going to.
Well, I know five people anyway
that
are Adlerians. And so it's like, well, it's always interested me what little I learned in grad school. And of course, then I picked this book up again. And one of the things I found here too is the varying ways that Adler's work can be used. And one of the chapters had to do with helping someone with career counseling. Understanding, and it sounds like early recollections, what do you think you want to do? Why would you never do that? And then the ideas around not so much you could do it or you can't do it, but challenging what they want to do and why they want to do it. Have you seen anything around that type of counseling?
Sure, yeah. It's a matter of, you know, of working with and challenging and exploring the sense of self. You know, just like what we're talking about, that becomes kind of the quintessential intervention of how is it that you see yourself? How did you come to see yourself that way? Is this a selective view of who you really are? Because, I mean, obviously it is, no matter how broad a view I might develop
for
of
sure,
myself,
yeah.
I'm necessarily excluding a lot of things. And it's, you know, kind of like what we were talking about with treatment, you know, where there's this balancing act between challenging the client and joining with them. It's, you know, like I've worked with a lot of trauma cases, and that is a real tension where on the one hand, here's your story and it's traumatic. And on the other hand, boy, wouldn't it be nice if it didn't have to be such a part of your identity? And I think, you know, if you look at less clinical applications like, you know, career counseling, it's always that similar dynamic tension. You know, do you love what you do day to day? Well, if not, how could it be different? Would you need to do something else, or would you just need to be a different person doing what you're doing and slightly change
your
approach?
It's interesting. There's a child psychologist guy named David Elkins who wrote, he was I don't know if he worked with Piaget or came out of that tradition, but one of the things he talked about in adolescence is this idea of a personal mythology that adolescents create. And I think it's fascinating, having worked with a lot of adolescents, having been one myself, I totally understand it. But I also think it applies to adults as well. It's kind of what you're talking about. And it also kind of goes to the idea of narrative therapy, right? These stories that we tell ourselves, these stories that we create to kind of get through life, right? To cope with the stresses and the anxieties of life, of living.
You know, Adlerians have this idea that's very similar about the family mythology.
Yeah.
Because Adler was always, you know, talking about...
Mm-hmm. Family constellation. Is that what he called it?
The family constellation is sort of the layout of the family. So Adler introduced the idea of birth order as being a psychologically important phenomenon.
Sure, sure.
Right. That was him, that's right.
But the family mythology is sort of these stories, these early recollections of sorts. So you say, well, oh, I remember this about myself as a kid, but it's not really your memory. It's what people said about you that you absorbed. Mm-hmm. And so you get this kind of narrative about yourself. And a lot of this stuff, you know, it's really sticky and can have really far-reaching implications and is completely below the level of any kind of critical analysis.
Right.
It's totally unconscious. You know, I can give you an example from my own life that for many, many years, for the majority of my life, I kind of always thought of myself as being this generally problematic person that's sort of difficult to deal with.
You?
Yes. And I I have this this family mythology around, you know, apparently I was very turbulent as a young child and I was sensitive to certain foods and I was, you know, colicky or something like this. And I remember there was actually an incident, well, I don't remember it, but I remember many incidents leading from it when I was, you know, still really an infant or a toddler. I was like 2 years old. My front teeth had just come in. And the story, as it goes in my family, is that it was the 4th of July, and we were out at a marina on these concrete steps watching a fireworks display. And as per usual, I was very rambunctious and jumping back and forth from mom's lap to dad's lap and back and forth. And soon they had lost control of me, and I went tumbling down. And sure enough, those brand new front teeth were broken off. And this led to, you know, medical intervention, and I was too young for anesthetics, and then it led to all sorts of, you know, dental problems growing up that had to be corrected. And so here is this long string of memories that led to very real problems that I had to experience pain and suffering and deal with. Mm-hmm. And it leads out from this story. In which the family mythology is that it's my fault. You know, I was this mm-hmm. totally uncontrollable child.
So the right? little kid was the fault.
Exactly. Yeah. And it I can't believe how many decades it took me to realize, well, wait a minute.
I couldn't have.
As a matter of fact, you know, somebody had a responsibility in this situation. And realizing that is like a window opening up on a hot day.
Even though you knew kids are dependent, it took a while for you to...
I didn't know I was dependent.
Well, and it's yeah. and it also goes to that idea, too, of that we often, as adults, look back at our child self mm-hmm. and judge ourselves from the perspective of being adults.
Right.
Instead of, well, I was, you know, I was two or I was three.
How could I have not known?
Right.
So would Adler say sometimes we may become what we believe we are, which is as far back as Aristotle? That kind of concept that we might, if we believe these stories, they may have something to do with how we see ourselves.
Yeah, I think the self-concept controls and directs the approach to the world. And that is the lifestyle. It's mm-hmm. this mm-hmm. interaction between what do I believe the world to be and how do I approach it based on that set of beliefs.
And I'm so amazed, again, how you could easily step out of Adlerian, this individual psychology, and you could, it's almost like you could step right into the door of strategic or
Absolutely.
Narrative, any postmodern thought. And so then I think of the interventions. Didn't he have the one called Spitting in the Soup?
Yes.
Which is sort of like, you're going to go on and do this, but once I spit in the soup and challenge it, you can yes. never go back to see it the same
well,
way.
Well, that's the same thing as Mnuchin's Dutch uncle, yeah. that you're going to come in and shake things up and push things around and then leave. And then the system will reorganize itself in some different way.
Yeah.
But not the same.
But it can
way
never
it
be
was.
The same again. And that was Adler's one of the, wasn't that him? Spitting in the soup?
It was Adler. I'm not sure if Adler himself developed that idea or if that was his Drucker, American Drucker's, students. Drucker's. It might have been a Dreikersian idea. I know that there's a little bit of or has been at least a rift between the East Coast and West Coast Adlerians.
Ooh.
With the West Coast
it's
Adlerians.
Like a hip-hop war?
Could be a reality show.
Yeah,
we could vote half of you
a lot of drive-bys.
Island.
A lot of drive-bys.
A lot of yeah,
Tupac,
lot of,
was. That's what happened. He was shot by an
We're going to go by and pull an inferiority complex on you.
Drive-by family therapy.
Yeah,
that's another Adlerian
right.
intervention.
So what, you know, before we move into another part of your career, what do you think, as we go away from Adler, for those who haven't heard a lot about Adler or newer students, what is there that they shouldn't miss? What's the key thing that Adler can help us as a therapist, do you think?
I think, you know, a lot of what we've been talking about with the style of living, that central concept, I think is such a powerful and useful unifying concept that oftentimes, you know, my training was largely Adlerian, and, you know, but nobody knows about Adler, and it doesn't really matter, theoretical orientation. Mm-hmm, and so mm-hmm. oftentimes, as I've developed through my career and training, I've kind of forgotten how Adlerian my perspective was until somebody asks me, well, why did you decide to see things this way or to do things that way? And often it all comes back to that central issue, the style of living. How does this person approach themselves and others in the world? How do they expect women to be? How do they expect men to be? how do they make a place for themselves?
And so it's still very, very pertinent to our modern times.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's nobody that you can't apply that central concept to, including animals, actually.
Right.
And well, how is this person making their way, you know?
Yeah.
The idea of family constellation and birth order becomes interesting for that reason, because like Adler would say that every child is born into a different family. And this is fundamentally
true. Yeah.
If I'm born to a brand new mother and father who have never had children before, oftentimes they'll be, you know, maybe they'll be very anxious. They won't know mm-hmm. what they're doing.
Or I'm perfect.
Or what?
Or I'm perfect.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that was our first child.
John would come up with that example.
Well, our first child, I remember our first child would fall asleep at 9 o'clock every night, and he got up about 6:30. He never woke up.
Oh, wow.
And we were saying, I don't understand the real hullabaloo people are making about kids. He's really been good.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
as soon as it took a little effort for the breastfeeding to work, but once it did, he was almost polite about it. It was on schedule.
Do you have any younger siblings?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
Oh, number two came along, and I love, we love him dearly. Absolutely so glad to have him, but he was like
a
bull
one.
In a china shop, you know? every 20 minutes breastfeeding, never slept. And then we had a third child, our daughter, who made them both look goofy.
Mm.
But it's true, even from the standpoint of the first child is born into a family with two people.
Right.
The second child is born into a family with three people.
That's one right. being a sibling. One being a sibling.
One being right. a competitor for competitor attention
or for resources.
Yeah.
So they're totally. It's totally, and even Bowen talked about the two people. I think this is Bowen. And two people are sort of inherently unstable, and they have a third to sort of focus some of their anxiety on.
Mm.
And then when the fourth comes along, what happens to that one? What happens to the next one after that? And where does the anxiety go? And is it
then dissipated? We get into coalitions or something maybe?
Yeah.
After that.
Yeah.
So the old joke, and you've all heard it, but for those who haven't, we always said and it wasn't our joke. You one child, you double team them, like basketball.
Yes.
Two, you play man to man. Three, you have to play in zones.
that's how it is.
Yeah.
You have three. Okay, so the other fascinating thing among many about you that we'd shared as an interest, and you practice more than me, I'm just dabbling, is in hypnotherapy, and you've been trained to do this. Now, I don't remember whether you had done work through the Milton Erickson Foundation or how you got into this. What can you tell us about that experience?
Hypnosis is one of those interesting subjects that kind of finds its way into particular people's paths for whatever reason. It's a subject that I first became interested in as a child and then forgot about for some number of years.
Sure.
And then became intensely interested in my early adulthood and then forgot about for some number of years. And then by chance, I ended up at a graduate school where at that time there was a professor who had set up and was running a 3-semester-long hypnosis certification course. And so I took that set of courses and became very good friends with that professor, and he introduced me to another person who ended up being my mentor for years in Chicago, a guy named Ed Frischholz, who had been trained by Herb Spiegel, whose son Dave Spiegel is the current, I think, dean of medicine at Stanford, and does a lot of neurological and hypnosis research. And I ended up involved with the Chicago Society of Clinical Hypnosis. And then Ed Frischholz brought me into the Society of Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis, and I was helping him teach workshops there.
So very much more expansive than your average clinician. Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of fell down the rabbit hole with it. I'm currently the secretary
no
of
pun intended,
APA
probably, right?
Division there. Wait, what?
No pun intended, right? Never mind.
Yes. Right now I'm secretary of APA Division 30, which is the Society of Psychological Hypnosis.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even know they had a division, but it would make sense.
Division 30 is hypnosis. Yeah. Everybody go and sign up if you can figure out how to navigate the damn APA website.
So God bless you, because, we just set this up and you even sent me a text, hey, I forgot to send this to you, and I haven't got to read it. So I want to talk about it. You authored a chapter in a book last year. Tell us about it.
The chapter in the book is a subject that, from the beginning of my involvement with hypnosis, way, way back, I was always ridiculously fascinated by Ericksonian hypnosis, hypnotic language patterns and
is that
suggestion.
Like neuro-linguistic programming?
That's where neuro-linguistic programming took its juice.
Gotcha.
Right?
Okay.
So the book chapter is formulating hypnotic suggestions, which is a fundamental segment in any basic hypnosis workshop. And it's one that over the years I've kind of crafted into something fairly unique in my approach, because for me, as for many of the people that trained me in hypnosis, I see hypnosis not as a discrete intervention, but more as a framework for working with and understanding the unconscious. And so I've long observed that anyone trained in hypnosis and who gets experience using hypnosis becomes a better therapist in talk therapy. Hmm. Because you find yourself more naturally listening for unconscious content and communicating with people on an unconscious level in a way that is fairly natural and easy. And that sounds almost like magical or creepy, but I lay it out in the book chapter fairly clearly, I hope, to where the fact is, you know, at any time that we're talking, I guess one of the ways that I'll explain it to my clients sometimes is like this. As we're talking, we're essentially, I need to find some way to transmit my internal experience into your brain. So I come up with these words, and I can't possibly tell you how it is that I arrive at the words
and the
sentence structures.
This is you talking to a client.
This is me talking.
He's hypnotizing us right now.
Well, this is me talking with you, and I've often said similar things to clients. You know, there's no way that I can possibly know how it is that I'm saying these things to you.
Right.
I have an idea. I have an internal experience. And furthermore, here you're receiving my words and you're listening to me and you're making some sort of sense out of them. And often that sense will be in the form of pictures or ideas or feelings.
And yet you're just now channeling it from somewhere. You know what you're saying, but only as you say it.
Exactly.
Out of some unconscious
filter. Right. This
filter.
Is what we've talked about.
We've talked
before,
about
this idea that the words that you're speaking come from some, we don't know where, because
and
you're
the
not
words
rehearsing
you...
them before you say them. You're not thinking about them before you say them. They're just coming out. And in receiving those words, I can totally understand what you're saying without having to sort of process, what does the word sense mean? What does the word it mean?
And
what
the word you choose must have some unconscious meaning because it is a choice, but you could have said a different word and it might have a different effect.
Yeah, there
it seems.
Because you're drawing on different associations.
And I've done a little neuro-linguistic programming, so I've dabbled, I begin to work with that. And when I listen to a client or when I watch where their eyes go, I can sometimes get a sense of whether they're more of a feeling person or more of a thinking person or auditory by how they look around when they're talking to me.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it works.
So let's kind of get back to sort of let's get into sort of some basics I think about hypnosis because I've never worked with hypnosis. I have I saw a guy on a cruise ship do a show once, right?
On the love boat.
So that's sort of that's my level of experience with hypnosis. But what if you were going to describe really what hypnosis is at a basic level?
Yeah,
how would you describe
and what you do? What you actually kind of roughly what you do as you're doing
or if there are different these sort of theories of hypnosis or ways that people work? Because I know Ericksonian is a little bit different than some others, but
There's been a lot of contentiousness in the hypnosis community.
There's another East West Coast.
North and South.
There's the big schools of thought are the sociocognitive people who, the sociocognitive theory of hypnosis is that you're creating a situation with certain demand characteristics whereby a person engages in a social process of responding in this, idiosyncratic way. But it all makes sense based on the way that the situation shapes their expectations and behavioral drive.
To a social construct.
Sure, okay. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Whereas the state hypnosis theory is that hypnosis is a state of consciousness as distinct from other states of consciousness in which certain types of thoughts are more or less possible, when compared to an ordinary waking state of consciousness. The Ericksonian school of thought is fairly atheoretical, but often makes reference to a trance state, But it's atheoretical in the sense that there doesn't seem to be broad agreement on whether that's just something spooky you say in order to help somebody. Because if you don't have, if I say, okay, go into a trance right now, we're just talking about how you have to make sense out of these words, mm-hmm. and that happens at an unconscious level. You don't know it. There's clearly an in-depth process happening, and neurologically we can see it.
So but you don't need a command to do it, then. You don't need a command because it's already embedded into the unconscious becoming conscious and then one understanding.
Well, let's put it this way and make it very, If I invent a mental state, I'm going to call it sui. I want you both to go into a state of sui at this moment. Now, you don't have any frame of reference for that,
right,
but you have to make some kind of meaning in order to understand what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And so, in theory, you could just kind of go into this spacey zone where it's like, well, I don't have a frame of reference. And that very well could be the exact same thing that happens if I ask you to go into a trance.
Yeah.
And so the hypnotic trance state could very well, and in many cases I think should be, thought of as this state of sort of lack of reference. You know, you're not plugged into any particular theory or model of the situation that you're in. And so you develop this kind of openness, this almost infant sensitivity.
The state is willing to change or able to change, and we don't even know to what, but it's in a place where it's, I don't know if it's sort of tied to suggestibility, but whatever it becomes, someone is becoming different than they were before they decided they were going to go along with this.
Personally, I kind of think of it in terms of, when I think of states of consciousness, I think that we're all in various forms of trance. I think that trance is a pretty good word for frame of mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that if you shift someone from their ordinary frame of mind to a different frame of mind, like, you know, when I'm at home sitting on the couch with my wife, I'm in a hell of a lot different state of mind, and I talk differently and I think differently than I am right now, or when I'm in a consulting room talking with a client. Or when I'm driving alone in my car, I'm in a way different state of mind. I'm not saying anything to anybody. Occasionally I'll get drawn out of that and I tend to get irate and yell something and then go back into my trance.
And occasionally you'll miss the whole experience, right? Where you'll be driving and
all
of a sudden get home and realize, my God, how did I get here?
You don't even remember making the right turns, but you ended up there.
That's a classic trance experience that just about everybody's had, you know, or the experience of crying in a movie theater. Why are you crying? Nothing happens to you. You know, those people aren't even real.
So your trance state changed to the trance state that's being suggested on the screen. And so a group has an experience together.
You've engaged imaginatively with something. And I think that's what we do all the time. Yeah. We just tell ourselves that what I'm engaging imaginatively with is really real this time, you know.
And I've always noticed, thinking about that idea of a trance state and shifting of state, that there's a moment where when you're working with a client and they kind of start to tear up, that's a really powerful pivot point almost. And if you can, if you can get them, guide them into that emotion, it can open up a lot of stuff, but often clients will get to that pivot point and back way off.
I see it every day. And I've been very influenced these past few years by, intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy. And I find those interventions so powerful when you see that emotion or that heavy sigh and to just take a step back from whatever the flow of the conversation is and say, wait, what happened there? Mm-hmm. Something just happened. Did you feel that? And of course they felt it because you could see them feeling it. But oftentimes we don't take the time to recognize that, I'm feeling something right now because I'm so driven to just keep on living my life
And it's also informative to you when you do that and they don't feel it, or they can't feel it, or they tell you they don't
Absolutely.
Feel it.
Then you know you're on something.
Yeah.
So without talking about any of your clients, can you give us some rough ideas of how hypnosis has been helpful to people in case studies? An idea of where you think it's best used.
Well, there's a 200-year literature on hypnosis. Most of the original, oldest literature was having to do with somatic disturbances. And hypnosis to this day has one of the largest bases of research support for the treatment of somatic disturbances, especially IBS. Hypnosis, I believe.
Irritable bowel syndrome, for those who don't know.
That's right, yeah. Irritable bowel syndrome is an idiopathic disturbance of the gut, you know. So unlike inflammatory bowel disease or Crohn's disease, which both have autoimmune and inflammatory components, irritable bowel syndrome, there's no structural difference in the way that a person's gut looks as far as current medicine can
tell. As to one who is not afflicted.
And yet...
In other words, there's not a germ. There's
right.
not a physical...
There's no infection. Okay. There's no autoimmune
process.
And
yet there's some
that
symptomology
of,
that people describe.
But these people can be miserable because of this symptom. I mean, imagine, you know, being in intestinal pain day in and day out, having diarrhea for years on end. It's horrible.
Sounds pretty bad.
It's a terrible thing. It's something that actually I've found hypnosis in my personal practice to be extremely helpful for. I've worked with a number of patients with IBS. Although I will say this about somaticizing patients as well. Some of my training was with chronic headache pain. I've worked with a bunch of IBS, and I've worked with a bunch of back pain. And I almost invariably find that in addition to the hypnotic interventions, which I'll almost always introduce if a person's a good candidate, is that some psychodynamic work is called for, because you almost invariably in a case of psychogenic somatic disturbance, you see a person with a repressive coping style. And they are, especially as a population, they're widely recognized as being especially resistant to psychological treatment, because they don't want to be drawn into this process of looking at exactly the things that they are transforming into this somatic
disturbance. So that's one of the ways you might see if someone's a good candidate, and there's a second part to this. So how do you determine that way if others, someone's a good candidate? And then if so, let's say with IBS, how does a hypnotist or a therapist using hypnosis work? What are some of the beginning stages of getting into this? How does it look?
What was the first question?
How
do you know someone's a candidate? Person's going to really be able to do this, and then with IBS, how would it look, the work?
There appears to be, to some degree, a genetic component in how hypnotizable a person is or what type of responsivity they have, although there's also some disagreement in the literature on that. Probably the most accurate view from my perspective is that hypnosis is not a unitary phenomenon, that it's actually a collection of phenomena, and that different individuals, based on genetic factors and personality factors, may be more or less susceptible to any of them. The research tends to suggest about 10% of people are not really hypnotizable at all. Most people have some degree of ability to access a trance state, and 10% of people are so highly hypnotizable, they're virtuosos, as they're called in the literature.
They may already come in hypnotized.
Oftentimes you need to teach them how to control their trance and how to ground themselves.
So you're working with something that's like a flowing river already, and you're just redirecting it.
Yes.
Something like that.
Oh, I love it when I occasionally, you know, someone will come into my office with some sort of problem that is just clearly trancy in nature. You can see the trance logic and how they have arranged their life, and you can see that as they're talking with you, their eyes are fluttering and they're staring off into space. And half the time you can just say, oh, well, you can find that problem gets better over the next week as you think about it more and more.
It sounds a bit dissociative.
And
as you're looking
you know?
At them, it sounds a bit dissociative.
Absolutely.
And so then you're saying, you know, you're already putting the suggestion, I think you're going to find in the next week that this is going to begin getting better.
And, you know, even people who aren't hypnosis people, like one of my favorite authors is Nancy McWilliams, and her series of books on psychoanalytic diagnoses.
And she did
and
all the stuff on personalities and stuff, yeah.
Even in her classic, widely revered for very good reason book, Psychoanalytic Diagnosis, which I highly recommend to anyone
book.
That hasn't read it.
Yeah, especially if you find yourself working with someone who's schizoid. You know,
absolutely.
I had to go to that book, and it was unbelievable how helpful that was.
Absolutely. Oftentimes, people who show a schizoid personality style, I will actually show them that chapter and let them take it home and read it.
And that does a difference?
And they'll come home,
right.
Or they'll come back to the session just like, I have never felt understood before. This
right.
is insane.
That's it's exactly like what happened with a 14-year-old, and they read it, yeah.
So how... trying to kind of, you know, think about this.
Yeah.
How much is hypnosis a thing that sort of you do with a client versus something that a client just experiences? You know what I mean?
It's It's a tricky question.
In other words, is it like technique-y or is it just something that
it
that
can
develops?
Be both.
Okay.
It can be either or anywhere in between. There are some people who use hypnosis and who train others to use hypnosis as a very, you know, technique driven. Here, let's, you know, sit down, we'll start with this induction procedure, I'll administer these suggestions and visualizations and things of that nature, I'll give you a post-hypnotic suggestion, I'll administer a re-alerting procedure, and then we'll be done. And you can use it that way, and oftentimes it works very well that way. In fact, oftentimes it works for a different set of people that way than the kind of other end of the spectrum, which would be very open-ended, very suggestive, very what's called permissive. You're giving suggestions that are very non-specific, kind of artfully vague. John Grinder, you mentioned NLP, was a big proponent of this artful vagary and indirection. And this is where, you know, in this case, and this is often the way that I practice in actually doing psychotherapy, rather than interrupt the flow of a course of ongoing therapy by saying, well, here, we're going to take a break and do this technique. Instead, I might lead someone through a sort of a thought experiment or a process that just invites them to turn their attention inward and to begin to narrow their range of focus. And this is essentially the exact thing that a hypnotic induction procedure does in a very explicit way. So a hypnotic induction procedure, what you'll do is you'll begin by inviting somebody to focus very intently on one thing, by suggesting that they narrow the range of their focus, turning that focus inward, suggesting that peripheral stimuli may become less significant. And in this way, a person kind of becomes more and more internally grounded and more less distractible and distracted. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of gives them access to be able to pick up on subtler thought processes and to be able to more easily engage with with processes that are more unconscious in nature. And so, you know, I might do the same thing in a therapy session by, you know, if somebody's telling me a story, you know, and you do this, both of you probably do this, and most of your listeners do this in various different schools of thought. Probably the most one-to-one mapping would be like, you know, Gestalt or some internal family systems work where you say, well, okay, well, what you're saying, can you imagine what it would be like if you had done it differently? How do you see that person responding? Well, here I'm inviting you to have this whole imaginative experience.
Right.
You kind of have to leave the room and hallucinate this for me.
It's interesting because it gets me thinking about guided imagery and things like that. Because often I'll do techniques, varying types of techniques that will invite the client to go down a descending staircase where we're counting the steps to a subterranean room that is on a cliff that has a window view outdoors. I don't decide what's out there, they do. Mm-hmm. But in the room, there are drawers they can open and books they can take out, or they tell me what's in the drawer, open it and see what you see. Tell me about the walls, describe the room, and they'll begin decorating the room. And they'll tell you these things. And then when you're done, you kind of ascend the stairs again and you count back. And I found it very interesting in getting people to a different state where they can talk, because they may come in extremely nervous, or they may be dissociating in some other way. And that's interesting, too, when you're in a room with someone who dissociates. So I'm kind of going all over the board here. But how does that part of guided imagery differ, or is it sort of an adjunct to some of the work of hypnosis?
I mean, what you just described is identical to the way that many people would initiate and finish up hypnosis. You know, the only thing that I didn't hear you mention that would typically be thought of as an integral part of a hypnosis session would be the deliberate administration of suggestions. And those suggestions can be, you know, direct and
based on the work you're doing.
Yeah,
that you know what their goals are.
Exactly.
Yes, I didn't put that in. If they know what their goals are, I reinforce them, but I'm not telling them things I want them to do.
Sure.
And many of them wouldn't. It's sort of, we've already talked about your goals.
And I guess this is you're talking about this very long history the research behind hypnosis. And yet there's still kind of this almost sort of, I guess, in the popular culture, this voodoo-y quality about it, right? Like, I'm going to wave this watch in front
it's
of you.
It's not a hard science.
Make you cluck like a chicken. Is Is it like that you can literally suggest something to somebody? Like, you hear it a lot for people want to stop smoking. Can you literally suggest something to somebody and it makes a fundamental change in the way they think or what they think about or how they think about themselves? Or is it, I'm guessing it's probably more subtle than that.
Well, the answer to that question is a conditional yes.
Okay.
For certain people with certain contexts, absolutely. You can make a suggestion, a very direct and plainly understandable suggestion that will measurably alter this person's experience or behavior. And that's, you know, a lot of the research is done using instruments which are designed to specifically do that. You know, so you'll administer the Stanford Hypnotic Susceptibility Scale, and you will suggest, you know, an auditory hallucination to someone. And then you'll record to what extent did they experience that auditory hallucination. You'll suggest, you know, an arm rigidity. You're unable to move your arm. It's stiff right. like a board, you right. know. And you'll measure the degree to which they become consciously unable to take that motor action.
So this is almost like you're going in and like doing an update on their system, and it's actually making a direct change in the way that it presents.
In some cases, yeah.
I was just thinking about how you'd work with someone with a conversion disorder or some other, you know, we talked about somatic issues.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that might be helpful. I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
I guess to kind of build off what RJ was saying is... It's if you think about, you can think about it in terms of updating their system, but it's very much a software change, right?
Right. That's exactly what it
is. Right. You know, in our software, kind of getting back to the Adlerian idea is the style of living, the beliefs about self, mm-hmm. the beliefs about things, and so, you know, if you can change what a person believes. Then they will behave differently. They will now behave in accordance with their new belief as opposed to they used to behave in accordance with their old belief. Now, and this is where the sociocognitive people have a very good argument to make. Well, here, I've done this spooky, you know, induction procedure with you. I've given you a very clear directive that from now on, every time you see a cigarette, you will be so nauseated, you must want to get away from there. And if I've set up a good context and I've set up a good situational demand, you could very well adopt that belief. And in fact, there's been some good research showing that there's no need for, in many cases, the hypnotic procedures and ritual. In many cases, you can give people suggestions, and if you do it in a certain way, they will just accept that suggestion and now believe what you told them, and they will respond accordingly to that new belief.
You're good, because I was going to ask you a question, and you kind of already answered it. I was going to throw you a curveball.
He had hypnotized you to answer that question. We didn't realize it was going on.
You already know what I was going to ask then. No, I was going to throw you a curveball and say, what do you think Adler would have said about this hypnosis? But you sort of talked about the style of life, so I'll go on to another. And I like to go into the weeds, and RJ does too with me sometimes, although he's usually the one pulling me back out. When we see movies, mm-hmm. you know, and I think, you know, you talked about the view we have of hypnotism. I think some of that voodoo quality comes from that. But what do you think, do you think that the application of this does end up in these covert, backroom, you know, dark state type stuff? Are there experiments that go on in spycraft and all this kind of stuff that talks about how to use this?
Absolutely, yeah. And there's a long documented history of it, and some of it is even creepier than you imagine. There's a guy named Al Shefflin who is a friend of mine, who was a good friend of my mentor, Ed Frischholz, and he's an attorney. I believe he's in Northern California. And he wrote a book many years ago called The Mind Manipulators, which details a lot of the CIA experiments.
So this was supposed to be a work of fiction, nonfiction.
And it's and obviously this was written, you know, decades ago. I heard him give a invited lecture to the Society of Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis when they were in San Francisco, I think in 2015. on that same subject, on hypnosis and the CIA and mind control.
So if you've seen The Manchurian Candidate, either the early John Frankenheimer movie or the new one, can that happen?
Well...
or am I getting into your security clearance?
And if you're listening to this and you're going to go out and look for it, go for the first one.
Yeah, absolutely. I was an intern of John Frankenheimer. Yes, go for the first one, of course.
You know, it's a question that to say yes would be a bit overly credulous, but to say no would be to be far too incredulous.
So there's something there.
There's a clear history of research and covert research, especially, and you know, I'm sure most
on both sides of the Cold War.
MK Ultra and the experiments that were going on with.
Yeah, I remember reading about that.
These agents to open the mind and create this sort of
these were the men who stare at goats, right? These peaceful mind warriors that and I've corresponded with Jim Shannon.
Oh, really?
Shannon, he lives in Hawaii, but yeah, this was a real thing, right? There really was the first Earth Battalion of using the mind to...
There have been, and in fact there have been a lot of experiments with remote viewing and lots of psychical research topics that that people generally assume are total hokum, and yet there has been a great deal of money spent on an ongoing basis over long periods of time by organizations that I assume wouldn't want to waste the money. So even though I'm not privy to a lot of their results, I have trouble believing.
And certainly,
they
if you listen to
Art Bell,
a lot about remote viewing.
Well, you won't listen to him anymore unless it's an archive.
Right.
But you know, I got to remember if this is a. I wouldn't say early recollection, but recent recollection. But I believe Dr. Jeffrey Zeig shared this with me, either, I can't remember if it was on the podcast or in private, that that Greg Bateson, mm-hmm. and I guess, was it Margaret Mead was his wife?
Yeah, Gregory Bateson.
Yeah, That's right. Had reached out to Milton Erickson at the beginning of World War II, like I think even before D-Day, because his work with hypnotism and being able to do basically... a setup of what a person's like. They wanted to understand the mind of the Japanese soldier and the German soldier, and they had reached to bring him into OSS to do early work on that, and he was probably in his 30s or younger. And there was a whole story about how they exchanged, you know, Margaret Mead would write on a cocktail napkin or a hotel stationery, and Dr. Erickson would respond in a 17-page, you know, triplicate photo, carbon copies,
right, yeah.
And he would write these detailed responses to them, and that he apparently had done some work with OSS around profiling
the
enemies.
And speaking of Jeffrey Zeig and Erickson, he talked about, when we did an interview with Jeffrey Zeig, in that interview, he talked about sitting with Milton Erickson and how Jeffrey Zeig had started smoking, I think it was a pipe.
He was smoking a pipe when they met, yeah.
And Erickson told him this story about something, I'll have to go back and listen to it myself, but something
how awkward.
How awkward it was to smoke a pipe. And he said he never smoked a pipe again.
He spent an hour talking about the awkwardness, and you're right.
That's right.
Art is right.
It's almost like a hypnotic suggestion in a way.
Yeah, because he said he had no intention of not smoking. By the way, I don't know if you've seen the book. I think he referenced the book when he was on, Dr. Zeig, but I have recently obtained 1967, I might be a first edition, I don't know, of a book that Jay Haley edited on the case studies and hypnosis techniques of Dr. Milton H. Erickson.
Yes.
And I've begun reading it over the last few weeks. And he does detail case studies of how he worked and exactly how he worked with a particular client to, I don't know what the term is, but to reduce a certain behavior or to overcome something that had been blocked in their head.
There are a large number of volumes. There's such a prolific expanse of work that Erickson wrote himself or had compiled by his various
students.
He wrote
a lot of stuff
and protégés.
For a guy who was wheelchair bound for a great deal of his life and in pain, could hardly move.
There's a great book, Hypnotic Realities, that I believe was edited by, I can't remember if it was by Haley or by Rossi.
Testing.
Okay, we're back. We had a little technical glitch. Let me ask that question again. If somebody were listening to this and were interested in getting into doing a little hypnosis, making it part of their practice, maybe doing a show on a cruise ship, where would they go? How would they get started?
Don't do a show on a cruise ship.
If you want to be effective.
If you, well, There are actually some recorded cases of deaths associated with
cruise ship therapy or hypnosis.
With entertainment hypnosis.
It's funny because I'll be honest. When we did it, we were on this cruise with a whole bunch of people. It was a big group that went, and this guy was doing the show. And you know, there's part of you that thinks this is a trick, right? This is magic. There's some, you know. Yeah. But one of the women with us, sitting in the audience, went under. And he had because he would do this thing where he would put the group under on stage. A few of them would go under, some of them wouldn't. He'd get rid of those, and then he'd go around the audience, and anybody that had gone under, he would wake them up to let them enjoy. You know, but that happened. And I was kind of
that
like,
selection
oh
process is everything in the stage hypnosis because what they're doing is they're going around and they're finding people who are A, willing to go along, B, highly hypnotizable, and C, usually have a little like a bit of a exhibitionist bent.
Show business imperative.
Right? And they weed out, and then they end up with people who are easily able to go into a trance. They put them in this situation in which the demand characteristic of the situation is intense. Yeah. Here's all these people looking watching at you, trying to have a good time, and it's all up to you to give it to them. You know? So here's, you're going under. You're not going to be conscious at all. Okay, all right. I'm gonna.
So we're not creating any cruise. We're not creating any cruise ship hypnotists. But if you're interested in doing this legitimately in your practice, making this part of your psychotherapy, where would you go?
Best place to start is probably to go to a 3-day workshop offered by either the Society of Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis or the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. They're both reputable, long-standing organizations. The membership is made up exclusively of licensed clinicians and clinicians in training. And the teachers will all be of very high repute academically and scientifically and clinically. And so, what you do is you go to one of these workshops, and over the course of 3 days, they'll teach you about, you know, some of the history and theories and definitions and all that. But probably the most valuable aspect is, you know, the hands-on practice. You break off into small groups or into dyads and practice hypnotizing each other. Practice, you know, going through hypnotic induction procedures and reawakenings and providing suggestions. And then not only do you get the experience of what it feels like, this very weird feeling to talk to somebody this way and to tell them to do these things that they shouldn't really be capable of doing, but also to have the experience of it happening yourself. I remember when I was in graduate school, the first time that I was in a small group practice or a dyadic practice with a friend of mine who, I think I went first and hypnotized her. We were doing age regression and we were doing arm levitation, you know, these really heavy duty, interesting hypnotic phenomena where you experience yourself going back to age 8, or you experience your arm doing things, you know, avolitionally that you're not consciously deciding to let it do. And I remember that experience of feeling my arm drift up into the air effortlessly and towards my face and looking at it with my eyes open and thinking, that is freaking amazing. I am not doing this.
Wow. You know?
Like, this is just happening. This is so cool.
And I imagine too, there's also like some sense of power in being the one that does that.
Yeah.
To put that suggestion into you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you can steal your own watch.
There's a whole paradigm breaking need, you know, in going through the training where you start to gain awareness of the power of developing a relationship with the unconscious and in communicating in unconscious ways and inviting people to enact behaviors unconsciously. And then once you kind of like, before you have a sense that that's possible, it would be very difficult to convincingly create a situation, a context where you could convey to somebody that this is the expectation, you know, but once you've experienced yourself, it's fascinating every time.
And then so you do some training, how do you become a practicing hypnotist? Do you accrue hours? There's no licensure for it, I don't think.
There's no licensure.
Certificate or?
There are certificates offered by both ASH and SESH, the American Society and the Society of Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis. And typically you'll go through the sequence. There's three segments of training. There's the basic workshop, which is, you know, a 3-day workshop, and the intermediate workshop is also a 3-day workshop. And this is an intense workshop. You're looking at like 30 plus hours over a course of 3 days. So you don't, You're blown out by the end and need to take some time to process it. But generally people, you know, it's graded to where you're taught pretty straightforward and direct things that you can apply at the beginning and ways that they can be applied in clinical practice. And you're encouraged to go and put it into practice and, you know, find someone to consult with or, you know, a supervisor who has more experience. And, you know, and don't be afraid to go in and actually put these things into practice and see how people respond to them, because, you know, you're already a trained clinician and mm-hmm. you're capable of dealing with psychological events and ab reactions. And so, you know, if something bad should happen, you'll be capable of doing it. And they teach you how to talk about adverse events and, you know.
Are you suggesting, and I'm not sure you are you suggesting if in one of these procedures someone dissociates?
Sure, exactly.
What do you do?
Well, and this is the reason why I so strongly advocate to everyone who will listen to me or whoever asks me about it, do not go to an unlicensed hypnotherapist.
The one I saw in that comic book in the back.
Yeah, and there's no regulation. Anyone in the state of California or most of the United States can hang up a shingle, call themselves a hypnotherapist. They could just read a book on hypnosis, and they may be very effective in some cases, as a matter of fact. But it's not uncommon for, in some cases, a trauma that you don't even remember, but oftentimes a trauma that you do remember, at least vaguely, to surface for unknown reasons during a hypnotic session. And this is a person who has no training in how to help contain that event.
So what you'd want to do, I guess, and you'd want to try to find a way to ground them.
Exactly.
To get them back into the room. You know,
precisely.
The old-fashioned, tell me five things you can see, tell me four things you can hear, tell me three things you can feel.
What you're saying is you want somebody that's a little bit of a lifeguard on duty.
Yeah, the general rule is, you know, don't attempt to treat anything with hypnosis that you would not be qualified to treat without hypnosis.
Okay.
And so, you know, like, you know, there are many MDs and dentists and chiropractors who are members of the societies, and they treat, you know, oftentimes medical conditions. Some of the greatest work that's being done in terms of infiltrating the medical system with hypnosis is by Elvira Lang out in Boston.
Say the name again?
Elvira Lang.
Elvira Lang. Great name.
She's an MD, a radiologist, who is teaching hospital staff to communicate, to use principles of hypnotic communication to teach hospital staff how to assist people through these intensely uncomfortable and invasive procedures in a much more comfortable and less threatening way.
I do a fair amount of work with individuals who are autistic. Is something like an autistic person, is this difficult to do with different types of states of neurological development?
It could be. I'm not aware of any research on...
Not that I've done it or plan to do it. I'm just interested in knowing.
Sure. It's something that I would be willing to try. The obstacle that I would see is, you know, the mental rigidity that you often see with people on the spectrum could make it difficult to shift state.
So that neurodiversity might be something that part that isn't developed or...
It could potentially, but again, I'm not aware of any research on that, and there are some unexpected findings in the research on hypnotic susceptibility in the past. Like, for example, you would expect that suggestibility as a personality trait would be related to hypnotic susceptibility, but they don't actually appear to have any kind of strong relationship.
I think the reason I asked is someone had just written a paper or suggested some research on how a nurse may, in fact, want to work differently with a person who is autistic, who is being going through intake into a hospital and being settled into a new environment. And to me, it seems like some of those skills could work in terms of suggesting something they're already comfortable with. Or
keep talking. I'm just going to go turn this air conditioner.
Or something that's like something they already know. So that's, I guess, why the question formulated for me. I don't know if we talked much about this, but what you sent me was the Handbook of Medical and Physiological Hypnosis.
Psychological.
I'm sorry, psychological.
Yeah.
You probably hypnotized me to say physiological. edited by Gary R. Elkins, and your Chapter 7, Formulating Hypnotic Suggestions, David Godot. Do you want to say anything about it? Because, I mean, can we link to this? Is it something we can link to or just...
Is it on Amazon?
The book is on Amazon, yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Okay, so, we'll so rather than linking to the chapter, just link to the book.
It's a big, thick book.
Is it used for training, like textbook or what is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. Gary Elkins is fairly prolific. He's developed a lot of textbooks. He does a lot of research. And actually, he's developed a technique that is a pretty simple and direct and non-threatening technique that he's got a good base of research behind that he calls hypnotic relaxation therapy. The non-threatening aspect, I think, is important when it comes to hypnosis. And one of the reasons why I basically was led over time to use hypnosis more indirectly and as a set of concepts than as a technique.
Because it freaks people out?
It freaks people out. And through like the whole time that I was training for my doctorate, I never was in a single clinical setting where I was able to do overt hypnosis. But I could always do visualization and mindfulness and guided meditations.
Mm-hmm. You're using aspects without ever using the word hypnosis.
I could do every single technique without exception that fall under the umbrella of hypnosis. Provided that you don't use the word hypnosis, it's a completely acceptable cognitive behavioral research.
And probably because it has that in sort of the popular culture, that voodoo equality about it. Yeah. Well, David, why don't we should probably finish up because we've been talking for a little over an hour here.
Okay.
So if you want to, give us any links we should have to these organizations people could look to for training.
Where can people find you?
I am in Long Beach in private practice. Long Beach, California, and I do psychotherapy and psychological testing. And actually, I'm in the process right now of launching a new and expanded psychological testing program. You can find the details at psychlab.us.
Cool.
And right now, it's kind of a framework, but over the coming months, there will be a lot more content there related to the usefulness of psychological testing and types of services.
We want to thank you for taking the time to sit with us. You had so much to offer. What a fantastic guest you are, and our listeners will be so lucky to.
It's been a great conversation. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks again for listening. I wanted to remind everyone that this episode is exclusively sponsored by Ben Caldwell Labs, creating a more effective, more empowered generation of psychotherapists. That's Ben Caldwell Labs at bencaldwelllabs.com. And if you guys want to write to us just to let us know what nice guys we are, or if you have questions or comments or ideas for future shows, anything like that, or just general fan mail, because, you know, I'm not immune to the flattery of that. You can do that at talkingtherapypodcast@gmail.com or check out our website at talkingtherapypodcast.com.